Hello, welcome to the Comic Connoisseurs. Today we'll be talking about writing from hindsight, where someone takes another writer's earlier idea and tries to improve it. And we're talking about examples where we think there actually is a market improvement. And of course, I'm my co-host, JD from Saskatoon.
Good evening.
Also, this is Red Ink.
What up?
So, this came from a phrase that Red said before when we were talking about the Invincible animated series on Amazon Prime. And that is Kirkman, directly involved in the series, is doing what Red calls writing from hindsight. And I'll let Red expose on that a little bit. Red?
Well, as I say, hindsight is 20/20. And Kirkman already wrote the entire Invincible series. He made mistakes, and he also did a lot of good when he was writing the series. And he's... when the TV series came out, he was able to see a lot of mistakes that he made and correct them, as well as add to the story. You had characters like Cecil show up a lot earlier, which makes the TV series a lot more interesting, since you have Cecil poking around. Just different things like that. Like, one thing is Amber, which... Amber was kind of like this vapid, ditzy girlfriend that Mark kind of like treated like shit. Well, never kind of treated like her. He treated her like shit. Like, she basically worshipped the fucking ground Mark walked on, until, especially after she found out he was a superhero. And then Mark cheated on her and dumped her. Basically treated her like shit. And the new Amber is kind of trying to fix that, but he went a little too far and then made this total fucking bitch that everybody hates.
Well, I mean, they went from one extreme with the vapid kind of almost Valley Girl sort of Amber in the comics, and then you have this socially conscious, volunteering at a soup kitchen, you know, berating Mark for, you know, not doing stuff, and made a very unlikable character. Yeah.
But overall, I think that the animated series is a definite improvement. But that's just one example. I wanted to do this topic show because I was reading through some older comics. And I remember that there was a very often maligned and hated and ignored by writers for years book that was done after Batman Year One. Done by Frank Miller, but done by someone else called Batman Year Two. And Batman Year Two is a mess. It is a mess. It is one of the weirdest, worst post-crisis books that came out before 2005. Yes, I'm putting qualifiers in those statements now. Thank you, DC Comics, for allowing me to put these qualifiers in these statements. So Batman Year 2 is a story about Bruce Wayne dating this young woman whose elderly father was a socialite in the Gotham's wealthy scene, who's lost his wife in a tragic, senseless crime on the streets. And the girl's father goes out at night as a vigilante called the Reaper, dressed in red leather with two giant ass scythes on his fists with guns attached to them. And Batman, in the middle of the story, decides, I can't handle a guy who dresses in leather. His leather is too strong. I can't punch through leather. I have to get a gun. And I'm serious. And Batman carries around a shoulder holstered, shoulder holster for Joe Chill's pistol. He's carrying around Joe Chill's fucking pistol in a shoulder holster.
What?
Yes. This is a real book. And he teams up with Joe Chill to fight the Reaper because the mob is as afraid the Reaper as Batman is. And him and Joe Chill, like, the mob's like, Batman shows up to the mob. He's like, you need me as much as I need you right now, because we both want to take down the Reaper. And the mob is like, yes, but you have to go with our top enforcer, Joe Chill.
Isn't Joe Chill locked up in the fucking in Blackgate? Like,
well, it's one of several variations of what happened to the
writers. Ignore year two. Other writers ignored the fuck out of year two. Year two is garbage. I'm serious when I'm calling year two fucking garbage.
Like, from what I remember, Joe Chill's story is he wasn't convicted for the murders of the Waynes, but he is in jail. And one time he does get out of jail, Batman confronts him, and he tells Joe Chill his fucking story that he's Joe Chill created him, and Joe Chill ends up dying, getting killed by the Joker and shit, because he's like, I created the Batman. They're like, what? You fucking asshole. And they don't even bother to listening to who the Batman is. They just kill him.
Yes. Well, that's the original pre-crisis. That's the original death of Joe Chill. There are several different versions of Joe Chill's story. This goes into another writing by hindsight. I almost kind of like a little bit of the idea of the what the New 52 did with Joe Chill's story, where Joe Chill is just a junkie that just randomly did it because he was just looking for money to score. And Batman confronts him because Batman, or I should say Bruce Wayne, because he's not Batman. Bruce Wayne has for years constructed like this fantasy in his head that his parents were important, because they are important, but his parents were so important that a secret society arranged the hit for some reason. And then,
are you talking about Court of Owls?
But it turns out that wasn't even a factor. That Court of Owls wasn't even a factor. That it really was just Joe Chill was just a junkie. And Bruce Wayne's like demoralized because he had like this fiction in his brain for like 10, 12 fucking years, and it just came crashing down. And then he sort of realized, you know what? It's still crime. You know, my parents still died from crime. I had to still fight crime. So it still turned into something good. There's an idea there, is what I'm saying.
I prefer the Long Halloween version where the Waynes were actually connected to the mob. Joe Chill was an assassin.
That's not a bad idea either, but you see what I'm saying is year two is garbage, is my point.
It is.
And there's this whole storyline about that, you know, the Reaper's daughter is Bruce Wayne's love, and he loves the Reaper's daughter and shit. And it feels like what happened was around 1991, 1992, Bruce Tim was like, hey, what's this thing? Oh, this thing's garbage. There's a couple ideas here. So he made Mask of the Phantasm, and he turned the idea of a Grim Reaper-esque villain that's connected to Bruce Wayne's first love into the Phantasm. Instead of the whole father angle, you know, Andrea Beaumont, the Phantasm, is using her father as a cover so she can say, oh, it's not me, it's my dad. And she's the murderer the whole time. Then you're starting to get some ideas. Mask of the Phantasm has pacing issues, by the way. I'm not saying it's a great movie. It's got pacing issues. But I think what Bruce Timm did was a marked improvement over year two.
I mean, he took the basic idea of this other vigilante who's kill crazy and, you know, molded that clay into something good.
Usable.
And good. Sorry, you go, Red.
Mask of the Phantasm was really fucking boring. And Bruce Timm admits that it was a rush job. Like, they had to get it out as fast as possible to hit a deadline.
Yeah, wasn't it originally supposed to have, like, a summer release or something, then it got pushed back to, like, Christmas?
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best things in that movie for me is the design of the Phantasm, because, like Ben was saying, you look at, you know, it was like Alan Davis and Todd McFarlane did the art on year two, and when you look at the Reaper, he looks like the love child of a leather daddy and Hellraiser, because he's got like this big black cape with like the white skull, and he's got like, he's dual wielding these scythes that have like guns built into like, what do you call them, the guards or whatever, because they almost kind of look like fencing guards, And he's got this leather studded costume that just...
Well, it sounds like something Todd McFarlane would fucking design.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is probably his prototype Spawn costume, honestly. But you got that. But the way they refined that and gave, simplified and refined, the best parts of that design. And thank you, Ben. Just look up Batman Year 2 Reaper, folks, and you will see what we're talking about. I mean... This guy would be a hit in San Francisco.
And also, but, I'm giving Red a picture of Batman with the...
Oh, my God. Now, I know Batman's history, and I know originally, yes, he did have a bat gun. But still... He
killed vampires with it.
It's fucking terrible.
But there
it's almost as bad as the new Batman movie that's coming out that he has the fucking gun on his chest.
Well, he has his gun on his chest. It's just a holster. no, this book is garbage. And if you read this, part of this I could give some excuses as post-crisis just started. They didn't really get a handle on things yet. They don't know what's going on yet. You know, this was made in 1987. Year One just came out. Everyone fucking loved it. And then they're like, oh, what are we going to do next? Well, let's give Batman a fucking gun and have a story about the Grim Reaper. Now,
I can't say I'm saying this, but thank God Tim Burton came around 2 years later.
Yeah. I mean, as far as the Batman with the gun, he had it in the Golden Age, and then he got rid of it because, you know, the first 4 or 5 years of Batman comics, it's just constant refinement of the elements that, you know, become intrinsic to the character. Now, as far as Batman having the gun, I do like that part where, for me, this is my favorite thing, or my favorite version of Batman and Joe Chill's gun, is where he puts it in the cornerstone of the building that's going to become the Wayne Foundation. And in my head, it's that one with, the gnarly tree that grows up through the middle of the building. He's got an elevator built through it to the Batcave under the street. And as far as the one in The Batman with Edward Cullen, I like the symbolic nature of that. I still think it's kind of dumb, but I don't hate it. And what Ben was talking about, you know, with it's more retcon. I suggested Spider-Man Chapter 1, and when I think about it, that's more retcon than in hindsight, I think, but I can appreciate one thing in there that I appreciate that John Byrne did versus the whole history of Spider-Man is right away you find out the reason why the robber was at Aunt May and Uncle Ben's house that night.
Is this the one where they put stash money in the house decades ago? And
well, that was the original version.
And the money's now all gone because Silverfish ate it?
Yeah, that's the Marvel 616 actual Spider-Man history explanation of why the robber was there. Now, in John Byrne's, he simplified it. It's still kind of dumb, but he simplified it, and I think it works a little better narratively. Is Uncle Ben goes into a computer store to, I forget if he was putting money down or he was wholesale buying an Apple computer for Peter as a reward for doing well in school. And the robber just happened to be working there as a stock boy. And he's like, well, hell, this old man's got a shit ton of money. I bet he's got more socked away at home. And also decided to rob the wrestling match that night that Peter didn't stop him when the guy's running down the hallway, thus giving rise to, you know, great power, great responsibility. And that's really the whole moment out of that, because that whole series is just retconning how Norman Osborn was always this Lex Luthor, Machiavellian planner, and they even have a moment where he sits down with Sandman, and Sandman notices, I see we go to the same barber, because for some reason he insisted on drawing both characters with that dumb cornrow-looking hair.
That used to be the style in the 60s.
Yeah, it's...
It was considered a profession. Yeah. It's...
But they also have...
And it's not corn rolls. It's weird. It's like a super perm. is what it is.
Yeah.
But
I mean, the chapter one, again, like I said, it's 90% retcons. Like, you have, like, the radiation demonstration that Peter goes to in, like, the original Lee and Ditko comics is now being run by Otto Octavius, and the accident that creates the radioactive spider that bites Peter is also the one that bonds Octavius's arms to him. And like I said, the computer thing and the robbers showing up at the house, they give him a simpler reason. Like, it just seems too much with that, you know, it's been laying in an old mattress for years and it's been eaten away by time and silverfish.
I think one of the best writing from hindsight retcons is it comes from a terrible fucking arc of Spider-Man called The Other.
Oh. There are some things I liked about The Other, though, but go on.
It's where Peter tells Aunt May he's Spider-Man.
I love
and
that.
And not only that, he confesses to her that he blames himself for Uncle Ben's death. And Aunt May breaks down. Because she blames herself for Uncle Ben's death. And she's been holding on to that for years.
Yeah.
Because the two of them had a fight, and Uncle Ben was sleeping on the couch that night.
And he went out for a walk to cool off, and he came back right when the robbers came in.
Yeah. And that story is preceded in, I forget if it's Peter Parker Spider-Man or Amazing Spider-Man, but Marvel had this one-month thing, Enough Said event, where all the
characters
Marvel comics... Yeah, no one spoke, and it was John Romita Jr. art, and Aunt May comes over to check on Peter, and he's passed out in bed in his tattered Spider-Man costume after getting, you know, roughed up by the Rhino or something. But the whole issue is about her, like, realizing, oh my God, he's Spider-Man, and cleaning up after Peter, and then subscribing to every other newspaper in New York City except the Daily Bugle. And she even writes a letter to Jonah saying, fuck your chicken strips. You guys don't know what you're doing when it comes to Spider-Man. You know, and then we have that wonderful issue where, you know, she and Peter have this incredible emotional moment, you know, coming together, and where she even, you know, kind of becomes his booster until, you know, a few years later, one more day happens and we all forgot about that.
The one thing I loved about Aunt May, the Aunt May that knows, is she is his booster. She is not his biggest fan. There are times she's critical of him, but she is the motherly figure that Peter needs. And I love the fact that she's on side. I love the fact that she understands why he does it. And I love the fact that she understands he needs to do it.
Yeah.
And she also understands the fact that he needs to be happy. And these are all things that the JMS understood about Spider-Man, and very few other writers after that point did. I feel like everyone wanted to just bring Aunt May back to, you know, where she was years and years and years ago every time. But if we want to talk about Spider-Man writing from hindsight, I think there's a big elephant in the room that we're not talking about. And of course I'm talking about at least the first couple arcs of Brian Michael Bendis' Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah. Writing from hindsight, I love the fact, one of the things I have always loved about Bendis' run on Ultimate Spider-Man was we don't lose Uncle Ben right away, and they build that relationship over the first few issues. Like, when we first meet Peter in there, and he's sitting at the mall, nose buried in a textbook, and he's waiting for Uncle Ben, and then Flash Thompson throws some, like, chili fries at him, and he's like, Uncle Ben stares him down. That, like, it's one of my favorite moments. Mark Bagley art, and Uncle Ben shows he's a little bit of a badass. I mean, sure, he's just staring a kid down in a food court, but I've always loved that moment.
The Uncle Ben that was in Ultimate Spider-Man is a different Uncle Ben, but it's the same spirit of Uncle Ben. I think that's what's important, because the Uncle Ben that we know of and are used to is one that didn't have a lot of page time we just have the mythos of Uncle Ben, the monolith of Uncle Ben, of this working class blue-collared man that has a simple but profound wisdom from his years, that has this wisdom and kindness that impacted Peter profoundly. And the Uncle Ben that we see in Ultimate Spider-Man is more of an old hippie. Not completely, but more of an old hippie. But he still has some of the same cloth, you know, some of that, you know, that profound wisdom of a kind and wise life. Because, you know, the way that he tried to handle the robbers, what I thought was very, very profound. And stuff like that.
To talk him down.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, when you brought up Spider-Man and retconning and hindsight, I thought you were going to say trouble.
Fuck you, Red.
Wow. No, we can do without that. Trouble is the Batman Year 2 of Spider-Man comics.
Well, there's a lot of Batman Year 2 Spider-Man comics.
Well, that's up
Trouble's
there.
Worse than that.
Yeah, Trouble's worse than Batman Year 2 at least has, you can say, oh, it's Todd McFarlane drawing it. I guess I could just stare at the art a little bit.
Yeah. No, the...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, JD. I just want to... Red, is this actually Todd McFarlane, or is this, quote, Todd McFarlane drawing this?
Well, the pictures that you showed me, they don't look like Todd McFarlane. They look like John Byrne.
That's Alan Davis art.
Yeah.
Okay. Because there is a period of time where it would say on the book Todd McFarlane, but it's not.
You're talking about Spawn.
It was more than Spawn.
It's pretty much like when Spawn started, the first two, or no, not the first two, I think it's up to maybe 11, issue 11, are credited that Todd McFarlane drew. But Greg Capullo revealed that he's been drawing Spawn since issue 1.
Yeah, it's McFarlane art, where you look at Capullo's art, and there's that scratchiness to it, but when it looks like steel wool sort of art, that's more McFarlane than anybody.
Well, Greg Capullo is a really good mimic artist, so...
Yeah, kind of hard to tell.
Yeah. Like, when he draws on his own, he draws really cleanly, and it looks beautiful, beautiful fucking art. But he mimicked Todd McFarlane's art style for, like, fucking 40 comics, and it just looks... Like Todd McFarlane, like somebody's having a seizure while they're drawing.
sorry for the segment. Go ahead, JT.
Yeah, I see. Like, in addition to you know, not fixing Uncle Ben, but making him, taking what we know about Uncle Ben and kind of rebuilding him like this. It's also one of the things I love how they did Aunt May. Like, they're both older, but they're not elderly. They're not. Aunt May's going to die if a stiff breeze and a leaf touch her, like she was written for so many years in the comics. And she's a force of nature, and she's reading about home remedies online, and, Peter's like, I'm going to go make some banana bread. And then she actually makes the goddamn banana bread, and Ben's like, oh, I'll try some. He's like, no, that's all for Peter. And Peter's like, are you serious? But she's a little more forceful. I can't think of the right word. It's agency.
When Jonah was going to stiff Peter's on his pay, Peter gave it the phone to Aunt May.
Oh yeah, and then Jonah's like, never do that again.
I liked Ultimate Spider-Man Aunt May because she was like an actual aunt. Like, she's older. Like, she's a woman in her 40s. She wasn't this fucking ancient 80-year-old fucking woman that was going to die at any fucking minute. Even though Peter went to college, age 30 years, she should be 100 fucking years old by that fucking time.
Yeah. And that's something to go back to, like, JMS and the other, we're talking about there. That's this reinvention of Aunt May kind of started with, like, when they ended Amazing Spider-Man and Peter Parker... and they had brought back, like, Aunt May had died during the Clone Saga, or just prior to the Clone Saga, and then they brought her back, and they made her, you know, not quite as lively as Ultimate May, but they made her a little sturdier than she was before, and that's, you know, what they do here, and...
She was goddamn mummy when she first premiered.
Oh, yeah, no, like, it's, seriously, she's, like, 10 more minutes in the oven, we're gonna have some prime jerky here. But the other characters in there, like how they reinvented Gwen Stacy as this, not, it's not perfect, but I found punk Gwen versus classic Gwen to be more, a little more compelling than that. Because, like, sorry?
Like, I was just going to say, I agree with you. Like, I find Ultimate Gwen a lot more interesting than original Gwen, because I'm sorry, original Gwen, she was only around for like 10 fucking comics, and I don't know why people fucking love her. She is a goddamn fucking billboard painting of the perfect girlfriend. She's as flat as a fucking pancake. She has no character whatsoever. She just looks hot. That's it. And people are just, oh, bring Gwen back. Oh, Gwen's so tragic and shit.
Yeah.
She was created to die.
Well, yeah. Actually, her dad was created to die, but she was basically, it was at the point where she died because the editor was like, either marry her off or kill her. Because the whole will they, won't they was getting too drawn in the tooth.
Yeah. But with Punk Gwen, like, when you first meet her in school, it's like Peter having to suck it up and take the abuse from Flash Thompson and Kenny Kong, who, if that guy's a high school student, I'm a super genius, because that dude had to have been 35 years old.
Well, haven't, like, you ever seen, haven't
that
you
was
ever seen
Brian Michael Bendis in a fucking,
yeah, but, you know, they punt Peter right in the ass, and then she pulls out a fucking knife and takes down Kong and Flash. And then when her dad, like, and it, you go, and it's not the perfect relationship that, you know, Captain Stacy and Gwen had in the classic comics. It's, you know, she's trouble, and he's not even asking her what's going on. She calls him, and you didn't even ask me what was going on, that these two assholes were picking on Peter like this, and no one was doing anything. Like, she became a protector in this very active role that Gwen Stacy never really had before. And then they turned her into Carnage.
Well, they turned a lot of people into Carnage. Like, let's move off the Ultimate Spider-Man. Because the further down we go, like, the early stuff is almost pure gold. But the further down we go, the more they mess with other concepts, the more stuff started getting long in the tooth. Like, there's a lot I love about Ultimate Spider-Man. But there's a lot that they messed up. So, let's talk about... What's another example we have of writing in hindsight? It's one thing I remembered was Thor Season 1. Thor Season 1 was a book that was by Matthew Sturges, I believe. And basically it goes down to this whole idea. Let's tell the Thor story from the beginning again. And what I liked about it was it handled a lot of the Donald Blake stuff really well. Because... lots of Thor writers just don't know what to do with Donald Blake. Like, is Donald Blake just an illusion Odin created for Thor to make Thor learn humility? Is Donald Blake the lie? What is Donald Blake? And it sort of, like, meanders here and there. And when the MCU really took off, like, a lot of the writers at a certain point just went, fuck it, he's just Thor. He's just always Thor. Fuck it.
Well, the MCU even made a reference to Donald Blake. He's like, who owns this shirt? Oh, my ex Donald.
Yes, that's true. But you get my point that what I liked was, here's a book that tried to handle that conundrum and tried to make something interesting about that. And, you know, Thor Season 1, I think the art was beautiful. I think that how it handled Jane Foster was nice, because Jane is this character that goes along on the trip, but she has an attachment to Donald Blake. She's in love with Donald Blake. She sees Thor, this big Norse, you know, beefcake, and she's like, "You're nice and all, but I'm here because Donald." And, you know, she never lost her faith in Donald Blake. And that sort of became important in the story. I think that that is something that was really interesting, because Jane Foster's another character that, like, other writers really didn't handle right after a certain point, because, like, after a certain point, people are like, what the fuck do we do with her? Let's make her Thor. Well, let's make her Valkyrie. Let's do this. Let's do that. And it's like, and I sort of like it here, because she doesn't have power. She doesn't gain Asgardian powers. She's just along for the ride, and she sort of is this grounding mechanism to sort of bring back the importance of what Donald Blake is.
And how they... See, I gotta read that one. I haven't read that, Ben, but when you think about Donald Blake, you look at how he's been used even in the 616 universe. Like, they eventually got rid of him. I think there was around the time in the 80s when Walt Simonson was writing, and Thor had the whole construction worker secret identity, wore glasses, and carried Mjolnir around in a bag. And then they had the Jake Olsen in the reboot title in the 90s, which was interesting, but only so much in is they were clearly aping the Thor and Donald Blake dynamic, and they never really used Donald Blake again until the aughts, when after killing Thor with the Ragnarok storyline, prior to the big Avengers reboot in the early aughts there with, like, New Avengers and that, and they brought him back, and he was kind of a tool of Asgardian magic to help resurrect the Asgardian gods.
Well, what happened is, just like in the movie, Mjolnir lands in New Mexico, and people are trying to pick it up, and nobody can move it and shit like that, and the Avengers have it guarded off, and so does the Fantastic Four. Then suddenly you see this guy just walking into the crater, and he has a fucking suitcase that says DB on it. And he just picks up the hammer and fucks off.
Yep.
You mean D.B. Cooper stole the hammer? Yeah, I remember that. And that was after, like, Doom, you know, pimps in there. It's like, Doom is worthy. What do you mean Doom isn't worthy? One of those things. But, yeah, Donald Blake was good. And then, like, we're talking before we got on air, folks, about a recent storyline in the Thor comic where Donald Blake's been living in this extra-dimensional Mayberry that he somehow gained sentience, because he was only ever supposed to be, like, this mask, you know, this veneer of a personality that Odin created for Thor so he could learn humility. And he goes mad and kills everyone there, including this giant dragon that was, like, guarding the place, and then he gets out and tries to screw over Thor in the real world. And just to swing back to Spider-Man for a second, when we're talking about writing from hindsight, I think you could also make the argument, have you guys ever read Untold Tales of Spider-Man?
No.
Okay. I say I have. It's ran for about 2 years between 95 and 97, written in its entirety by Kurt Busiek. And there were a few issues, but it was a Pat Oliff, or Oliff, did the thing. And it's set in high school Spider-Man before college. And again, a lot of retconning, but there is stuff in there in way, you know, Peter deals with Aunt May and deals with Flash and other characters, and even some of the original characters created for that series, that, you know, it's not just Peter was just a nerd and then he was Spider-Man. Like, he had subtlety and nuance. And I think a lot of people gloss over that because there's just a metric shit ton of retconning. So, what other writing from hindsight do you have, Ben?
Well, you know, thinking about it, the writing from hindsight really applies well to adaptation. And another example I can think of definitely is the first Iron Man movie, because if you think about it, you're trying to introduce the core concepts of who Tony Stark and Iron Man is to a movie going generation that only knows, oh, it's the guy with the bucket on his head from the cartoon from the 90s. I think I saw that once and tried to distill it all into 2 hours. And that's, I think that John Favreau and the team and the Robert Downey Jr. in the portrayal did a great job of distilling it down and putting it all together in a way that is believable. And go ahead, go ahead, Red.
I thought for sure, like, this isn't me kidding. When you brought up Iron Man and retconning and stuff, I was like, are you going to bring up Teen Tony?
Fuck you.
Wow, that's two fuck yous to Red in one episode, Ben. You going to go for the record?
The hat trick?
Yeah, the trifecta. Yeah, no, I mean, when you think about, as much as I've always loved Iron Man, you know, what, and it's not like you always have to hang it on Tony being a drunk a-hole. It's a lot of guys, like, once you get past Tony, like, you know, Demon in the Bottle is a great story, but after that,
what is it's there?
Just, yeah, because, I mean, from Demon in a Bottle and, you know, the rebirth of Tony, you know, going through, like, the original Armor Wars and through until, you know, Avengers Disassembled, where, you know, Scarlet Witch went mad and cast a spell that made Tony appear to be drunk when he was still Secretary of Defense. Dear God, that was a horrible storyline. But it's eventually he just became this bon vivant, you know, like charismatic, you know, he knows people over the world and he knows women in every city sort of thing. Like, it just became like they leaned on the Playboy image for like 20 years before they brought it back to having some sort of problem for him to balance everything else out.
Yeah, well, what happened?
Galactus, you taste.
Yes.
Well, what happened was Robert Downey Jr. happened.
Because exactly. And
as we established before in the show, before that, Tony Stark was Howard Hughes.
He was Howard Hughes, then he became Magnum P.I.
Yes, and then he became Robert Downey Jr. Like, and now they're trying to turn back into Howard Hughes, and it's not working.
What's the line that they had in Iron Man 2 where he says, never has there been a greater example of Phoenix personified? I'm paraphrasing the line at best. And that's both Tony talking about himself and, you know, the writers commentating on how they, well, of course, the Iron Man and Robert Downey Jr., like, he was, you know, Tony Stark. You know, he had these problems. He was trying to mount a comeback. He stumbled, such like that. And that's why it works so well, because this is RDJ and Iron Man is kind of like Christopher Reeve and Superman. Like, it just works. And yeah, it's, and then they simplified stuff. I mean, this was the first one. This might be a one and done for Marvel. Like, I'm under no illusions that they, you know, they have that Avengers stinger at the end, but they weren't like full bore going for the Marvel movie universe just yet.
Now, there's one thing I have to add, that there's one piece of writing from hindsight that I think is very important that I wish was put in the comics. In the season one of the Daredevil Netflix series had this moment where Matt Murdock is talking to Foggy and he's revealed his secret, you know, after he has to get patched up. And he's and not Foggy, the chick, the night nurse. And he explains how he sees. He explains what he sees, how his brain perceives things. And he says, it's a world on fire. And that, I think, was like a great piece of visual symbology that... Go ahead, Greg.
It's a great piece of visual symbology, like you said, but it's also, if you could see smells, that's how the world would fucking look.
Like, and that synthasia condition?
Yeah, like, not synthasia. Synthasia is the opposite. You smell what you see.
Okay.
But Matt Murdock's senses are so fucking keen and so in there, like dialed in there, that he doesn't actually see, but he's trying to describe how he perceives the world, and one of them is smell. It's probably the strongest one for him, and it would be like fucking flames wafting off of everything, and that it would be like a world on fucking fire.
And I just love the way that they showed just that image that he has of the world on fire. Like it fits with it, and because like whenever any other comic in the past has shown how Daredevil sees with his radar vision, it's literally like sonar. It's just a bunch of lines, and I get it.
It's like the Ben Affleck version.
What?
Yeah.
The Affleck version. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there's one part of the fucking Mark Waid Daredevil run that I actually kind of liked was Mark Waid looked through what do you call it, Red? The thing of the month.
The Mort of the Month.
Yeah, and found out that there was this old Marvel character called the Shroud, who is basically Batman Daredevil.
You're not wrong.
And Mark Waid's like, well, Jesus Christ, let's have the two meet. And there's lots of comedy in that scene, and I know we're kind of off topic, I just have to bring it up because Bat's girlfriend at the time is reading up the dossier on the Shroud. Like, they burnt out his eyes with a cattle brand. How can he see and move around without his eyes? And then all of a sudden everyone looks at Matt like, oh, that's right. And Matt's like, it's not that hard once you learn how.
Yeah, I remember that part of the Shroud's origin. Like it's like he goes, like Bruce Wayne goes out and gets all this training, seeks out this cult, and it's this brand that kind of looks like a spider too, and they just plug that thing into his face, like it's like Doctor Doom, except it's just his eyes. And then it kind of melts like half his nose off too.
Yeah.
Oh Lord.
And you also have a scene where you have It shows the Shroud and the Daredevil's radar senses bouncing off each other, and they look completely different. But back to what I was saying is, if a Marvel writer could somehow incorporate a world on fire, I would love to see it. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because I think that piece of imagery, because it means more than just everything's waffing. But that does make sense, what Red's saying about smells permeate and waft, but it also symbolizes how Matt, like, runs himself fucking ragged trying to save a world on fire. And the devil imagery, everything, it ties to so much about him.
Yeah. See, like, some of the stuff in the over the course of the three seasons of Daredevil, like, they made me care about Bullseye in the third season. Like, sure, he's still got the deadly aim, but I, you know, kind of empathize a little bit with him. Like, you know, you see how, what his life was like, and, you know, no one really understanding him, not really having, like, strong parental figures. I can understand how this guy might be that way, which is...
He was killing animals as a kid. Like,
I know that. Psycho. I didn't say I liked everything. It's just... I like that version. Like, I think that version of Bullseye works better than he's just this insane man who killed animals and people and basically whatever he felt like as a kid, you know, versus this guy that, you know, he had this damage, but, you know, then you get Vincent D'Onofrio's Kingpin in there and he gets that focus a little bit. I mean, horrible character in terms of his character, not in terms of like the creation, how they executed that. I think that worked really good. Also, Foggy.
Because I think the Bullseye or the Daredevil TV series does count as writing from hindsight, because it is based off of the Frank Miller's run, Born Again.
Yes. Well, it's based off of several different runs. It's condensing and putting together the best elements of 35 years of comics into one series, because that's what you really need to do to get the distillation of Daredevil. You even have a little bit of that Daredevil failed TV pilot from the 80s in there with the first costume.
Oh, with Street Hawk from the Incredible Hulk movie?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that would have been a great series. I probably would have enjoyed it a little bit. I mean, was it Rex Smith as Matt Murdock? Weren't they going to give him a dog in that?
I don't know.
If they made it a series, JT, you would have the VHS, the DVD, and the Blu-ray.
He'd have I've never been interested in Laserdisc. And I'll have you know, Red, that the only thing that I have on DVD and Blu-ray is Godzilla and Child's Play. Only the first two movies, because Child's Play 3 I don't really care for, and I just like the first two. I mean, when you reboot characters too, like, is that, can we consider that writing from hindsight?
Somewhat,
if it's,
yes,
like a complete, you know, like Ultimate Marvel in that. Because you mentioned like New 52 and like, dear God.
We don't want to go into a complete reboot.
Ignoring hindsight. That's,
yeah, very much so. Where you look at, what is it, X-Men Second Genesis. I mean, that's way more retconning than writing from hindsight, because, you know, that's, you know, you bring in the third Summers brother, and all of a sudden, like, all they could do with Professor X for like the next several years is write about how he is just this incredible asshole. And it was like, well, why are you guys focusing on that? We've known that for years. We've read the comics. But I mean, you have that. Because once you get out of the big
Charles, what are you doing out of the basement? I just wanted something to do.
So, Red brought up a great point, and that was Supreme. And
yeah.
Supreme,
you
is
mean Rob Liefeld's Superman knockoff?
Well, let's talk about that, because I think that's where we start with Supreme. Supreme was a Rob Liefeld property that Rob Liefeld created, and the first Supreme arcs were not well received. And Rob, you know, made quite a lot of money early on in his career, because, you know, shit on him all you want, but the man knew how to market his abilities, knew how to market his name and himself, and knew how to get in early on the ground floor of a lot of different things. And,
well, he is the one who created Image Comics, even though Todd McFarlane's like, it was me all along.
Yeah, I know. Well, Todd McFarlane is a little, well, okay. Nearly everyone in that bullpen were egomaniacs. Full stop. But my point is,
no, really,
Rob Liefeld at least knew how to swallow enough of his ego that when he approached Alan Moore and said, hey, I want you to write Supreme. I want you to write my Superman. And Alan Moore looked at it and said, this is garbage. This is a mess. If I write this, I have the right to jettison all you did. And I'm going to keep just the look of the character and the basic powers. Everything else is going to be me. And any other creator in the world that would be young and full of ego would be, like, offended by this. Or try to fight back, or try to be like, well, let me at least have some editorial control. Let me be able to veto some things you want to do. But I'll give Rob Liefeld this. Rob Liefeld knew, I don't care what it takes, I want Alan Moore to write Supreme. And he said yes. And like I said, shit on Rob Liefeld about his art, about everything else. But you know how much it takes for a creator to do that, to be able to say, be able to be told to his face, what you created sucks. I'll only do it if I'm able to jettison everything. No complaint.
But it's Alan Moore. Like, he's known to be fucking, like, brutally honest.
I know, but what I'm saying is, you know how hard it is for a young creator, because, what was he, like, 20, 21 back then?
No, he's probably, like, in his 30s back then, but, yeah, he's still young.
And, like I said, that takes a lot of, like, being able to swallow your pride, swallow your ego, be able to be like, yes, that, and what he created, what Alan Moore Supreme is a love letter to the Silver Age Superman.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you get artists, like you had Ian Churchill do a whole bunch of those issues, but it's the artists, when they do the flashback stories to, like, you know, to the Golden Age era Supreme or the Silver Age stuff, and even the 70s and the 80s, like, they get artists to evoke, you know, the style of the time. Like, there's, I think it was in the, not the first Supreme series that he did, because he did a 12 issue run, and then he did another run after that, and in there's a story where Supreme's, like, part of his myth, like, the backstory is he's been wandering the universe since the 70s, and he ends up in this world where he runs into the Jack-O-Lantern, who's, like, kind of the specter of this universe. And the art in there is, like, very much like, you know, Neil Adams-esque, like, very trippy sort of, definitely some Steve Ditko visuals in there. And, but it's the Chris Sprouse, like, from Tom Strong, that, you know, he and Alan Moore had created that. It was a few years after this. That's where they first team up here on Supreme. And Chris Sprouse just has this innate classic style. You know, if he did like a whole, say he did a whole line of like Marvel or DC comics where it's just, he's got this very clean art that just evokes the Silver Age. And I thought it worked great with Alan Moore's writing.
And the other thing I have to add about this is, even though, like I said, even though the whole thing about I'm going to just as everything you did that he said to Rob Liefeld, Moore kind of kept some of Liefeld's Supreme in there with this whole thing about, you know, there's different Supremes, different universes, and they communicate and stuff like that. And he didn't completely jettison all that. There, he showed some respect to what Liefeld created before, even though it wasn't as good. And so, there, like, I think, you know...
Now,
go ahead, Greg.
Liefeld didn't really write Supreme. He created the comic. He didn't write it.
Okay. Okay, you're right about
so
that.
So that's probably why he was like, okay, just throw it all away. I don't give a shit.
Because he did. Sorry, you go, Ben.
But like I said, at least there was some acknowledgement of the past and honoring of the past there. That was my point I was giving there.
Yeah. Although there was not a lot of acknowledgement of the past, because basically it's like a few panels where he runs into like Lady Supreme and Kid Supreme in this extra dimensional. So was it the, what do they call it? The Supremacy,
yes,
which is like this heaven for like, and I love the meta commentary on how there periodically there are these cosmic level events called revisions where, you know, there's a Lady Supreme from the 70s and it's, you know, Pam Grier in a Supreme costume, or there's Squeak the Supreme Mouse, who's very much out of like a talkie-tawny Captain Marvel kind of thing. And what about this giant, you know, Supreme? He only lasted for a single issue. You know, I love that, how he reflected on the history of comics and, you know, reboots and revisions like that. I thought that was a really cool nod, too. Because he's not forgetting the history. Like, it's there. It's always going to be there. It's almost like Alan Moore saying, just because they've rebooted your favorite character doesn't mean you can't read those stories again.
Yeah. And like I said, I think that there's something special about the way Alan Moore treated Supreme and what he turned it into from what it was. Because before, it was just like one of the many, many edgy Superman reboots we and revisions and recolors, as we would say, that came out in the 90s. And more turned into a fucking love letter.
Can't see a lot for some of the other reboots like that. Like, and it's not even right. Reboots aren't writing from hindsight. There's few in there, but it would take too long to dig that pile.
Absolutely.
Like, the only other thing I can think of writing from hindsight. Now, you mentioned, you know, Thor season one.
Yes.
I've read a couple of the Marvel season one books, and I do like what they are trying to do there. You know, but it doesn't all work. But some of the things that do work is if you can ever find the Marvel Mythos from, I think it's around 2005 or something like that. And it's these fully painted one shots, which are very, it's basically, you know, these are the origin stories. And one of my favorites is the Ghost Rider one, which, you know, it starts with Johnny Blaze. He's recently become the Ghost Rider. It goes over, you know, it smoothed out some of the rough edges of the whole selling his soul to save Crash Simpson and becoming this flame-headed skeleton on a hog. And it just smooths it over. You know, it's quick strokes. It's done in one. For some reason, they choose to make the devil look like John Tesh from Entertainment Tonight. And it ends with one of my favorite Ghost Rider images of Johnny Blaze doing this leap over, like, 10 school buses. You know, no one's ever tried this before. And he times it so when the sun goes down, he becomes the Ghost Rider in mid-jump. And it's playing, you know, late, instead of playing Bon Jovi's Blaze of Glory, he puts on Ghost Riders in the Sky.
Is that where that scene comes from in that fucking reboot of Marvel's? Yeah. I can't remember the name of it. But they did a second Marvel's run where the world is just a horrible place and Johnny Blaze jumps 10 fucking school buses and lights his head on fire mid-jump.
I've never read the second Marvel's. I honestly didn't know it existed. I thought you were going to call it the Nick Cage movie.
It's horrible. Don't fucking read it. Like, it's,
I don't intend to, Red.
It's like a what if the Marvel Universe was actually realistic and superheroes didn't really exist and it's stupid. It's fucking horrible.
Yes, it is.
No, but it's stuff like that where you can, because it's a one shot. It's not in canon, but it just, it's the benefit of that history and looking back what has and has not worked about a character. And, you know, if they just got it right with that one.
Yes. All right. Do we have any other examples we can think of writing from hindsight?
Okay. I can bring up the Transformers. I know you guys don't like the IDW Transformers continuity. We have established that before.
Bop off of me.
Yes. But what I think writing from hindsight with the current where IDW, they still have the license, they rebooted it, and I think they learned from what worked and didn't work with the original run of their Transformers comics with the current run where it's getting into the origins of the Great War. They've got Alita 1 and RC and Chromia and all the other female, like, they're just there. There have always been female Transformers, which,
yay, again, no trannies.
It's just,
didn't they kind of retcon that? Because,
well,
they had a Transformer that was turned into a female.
That was in the previous. That was not IDW. That was the previous owners. And what it was Galvatron had a brother that was turned into RC. Had to lop it off of me.
Well, I could tell you exactly what happened, Ben, because, you know, I read those comics. He's not wrong, Red.
Don't try to make it better.
I'm not trying to make it better. I am simply trying to explain it clearly.
Oh, God. Red, before JT tries to make it better, I want you to...
I'm not trying to make it better.
Let me finish my sentence. remember what I said. Galvatron's brother, kidnapped, tortured, got lopped off of me, and now have JT's explanation. Tell me which explanation was better. Go, JT.
You know, I don't really feel like telling you now because I don't appreciate your attitude, Ben.
Tell, come on.
Okay, RC was always named RC. It's in the original comics, it was written by Simon Furman, who's always been one of this old boys club. Like, he was a very active part of not bringing in any female characters or not setting up any sort of romantic relationships in both the Marvel UK and Marvel US Transformers comics. And he's the one that wrote the Lop It Off of Me that Ben speaks of, where in the original art, Galvatron and RC are both drawn to look like that really chunky Galvatron toy from the G1's toy run. Now, they had that, and the explanation for why the mad scientist GX is that he just wanted to see if he could. But then, years later, I forget which writer first introduced this, that they said, like, no, that's sick and gross. And they wrote that female Transformers have always existed. It's just at some point in their history, Shockwave went back in time and lit off an EMP that wiped everyone's memories, and all the male Transformers forgot about the girls. None of that really makes it better. That's literally what happened. That's not even
they're right. Fucking robots. Who gives a shit if there's men and women? Like, as long they just look like men and women.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why not, but I mean, it would take way too long, and I don't want to get that far in the minutia. It's just that's how they quote unquote made it better. I don't think it really made it better, but I think the second, you know, it's Transformers are so old they just forgot. Because I agree with Ben, you know, it took me a while to come around to the whole forced sex change thing. That was just gross. I mean, I love Simon Furman, a lot of Simon Furman's work on the Transformers, but that's just like, dude, pull your head out of your ass.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah.
Originally, Ratchet was supposed to be female, and then they changed it because they're like, oh, these toys are for boys. We don't want any girls on the team.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying with the current, like, you know, Transformers run, like, where they reboot, it's a completely new thing. You know, there's just male and female characters. They're concentrating the origins of the Great War, like I said. And it's a lot more cohesive and a lot more, well, not simple, but it's not as meandering as the previous Transformers continuity became. Especially when they forced the Hasbro verse onto everything. So. Jesus, the thunder's getting loud.
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening.
Me.
Galileo.
Yeah.
Anyways, I can't think of any other examples of writing from hindsight, and we just passed the hour mark, so any other examples we want to hit before we wrap things up, boys?
Read the first volume of Alan Moore's Supreme. It's on a definite must-read list for me.
Don't read Batman Year 2. It's awful.
Red.
Watch Invincible, the TV series.
All right. What's your host, Ben?
JT from Saskatoon.
Reading.
We're saying goodnight.
So long.
I can't believe I listened to that whole explanation.